Thank you for inviting me to give this talk. And this is based on a very short paper, so this talk is not going to really take long. And I would imagine that you can interrupt me, and it's a very friendly talk. You can stop me anytime you want, and we can make sure all the concepts are clear as we go over the concepts of this paper. The idea behind this paper is that we want to measure expansion rate at high redshifts only based on gravitational wave data. So let's see how we can do this. Let me see. Okay. So generally speaking, whenever we want to measure Hubble constant, we need two ingredients. One is the redshift to the source, and the other is the distance, the luminosity distance to the source. So whenever you have these two quantities about a source, then you can measure what is the expansion rate at the redshift that you have measured for the source. Well, okay, so redshift normally is observed through the electromagnetic counterpart of a gravitational wave source. And the way you measure redshift from the gravitational and from the electromagnetic counterpart is just basically to see how much the light is redshifted. And we all know how to do this, and this is how you get the redshift. The luminosity distance to the source from gravitational wave data comes from analyzing the waveform, analyzing the phase of the waveform, and the phase of the waveform informs you about the spin and mass of the objects. And when you have a knowledge about the spin and mass of the objects, you know the waveform model that gives you the amplitude of the wave, what it should be, and you have an observed amplitude, and you can basically derive the luminosity distance to the source from the gravitational wave data this way directly. So this has been done many times before for LIGO observations of specifically binary neutrino stars. And basically anything that has a proxy for redshift. So in this paper, we put out this idea that can we infer the redshift from a quantity that is independent of redshift? So we know that the observed mass of a source from any gravitational wave observation is redshifted. So what we observe is 1 plus z times what is the actual mass of the object in the universe. However, we have two objects, the primary and the secondary. If we divide out these two, we get the mass ratio, and the mass ratio, of course, does not have any dependency on redshift. So okay, so we get the DL, the distance to the source from the gravitational wave data, and we have an independent quantity or parameter that independent of redshift parameter that is called mass ratio. Now, the idea is that do we have an independent estimate of redshift based on the mass ratio? This has nothing to do with the gravitational wave data anymore. You measure the Q. Q is from gravitational wave data, and Q is independent of redshift, but you again want to tie it to redshift because again, at the end of the game, all you need is redshift and luminosity distance. So the paper is about, is there a probability of redshift given mass ratio from some other principles in nature that we can use to infer the redshift? Is this clear? If this is clear, we can move on to next slide. Okay.
Yes.
So what we basically said is that, if we want to measure, first of all, Okay, so the first thing is that however you want to attack this problem, if this is the way you want to approach it, how well can you measure mass ratio? The mass ratio is actually measured very well for LISO sources, for supermassive black holes. And this plot shows that, for example, at an SNR of 100, if a source has Q equal to 1 and the source mass is around 10 to the 5, 10 to the 6, you basically see any everything in the universe with LISO. And the same is, so these are 1/5, 1/10, 1/20th, but like even a Q of a half is pretty much similar to Q of 1. And the observable universe is at your hand to is in your hand to observe. I mean, there is not much of selection effect that would go on. So you're basically this is telling you that I'm not gonna miss on a lot of sources because I cannot really detect. I am like my sensitivity to mass ratio is a lot. So you're basically you're saying that you're not really that sensitive to the mass ratio with LISA, which is great. So we get this confidence, and then okay, and then we move forward and say that, and this is the core of the theory, that generally speaking, we know that there is a hierarchical structure formation in the universe. And specifically for supermassive black holes, one of the leading theories is that everything starts with some sort of a seed mass. That seed mass can be 10 to 3, 10 to 4, 10 to 5, we don't know. But there's a seed mass. People assume different PDFs for this seed mass, log normal, whatever, delta function. And so, but there is a peak and there is some dispersion around the peak. But this is how the universe starts. So at the beginning, everything is sampled from the seed mass. Therefore, the first mergers in the universe have to have a Q approximately one, a mass ratio of approximately one, because these are all seed masses that are merging together. And as we move on, there is a hierarchical structure formation. And of course, then the asymmetric mergers happen in the universe. There is this whole this other galaxy that merges with a tiny, like a bigger galaxy that merges with the dwarf galaxy, and all kinds of asymmetric mergers take place in the universe as the universe gets older. So the idea that we had is, if this is the case, equal mass ratios tend to take place at higher redshift as opposed to asymmetric mass ratios. So this has nothing to do with the gravitational wave data. This is just, you have an idea, you say, oh, this is how the universe should behave. And then we went in and we analyzed the cosmological hydrodynamical simulation of Astrid at the Astrid simulations. And then we just plotted how many or what the fraction of sources that have mass ratios less than, let's say, 0.5. Maybe you can plot this however you like. You can plot it as a function of like how often do you see Q of one happening as a function of redshift in the universe. So what we see is that yes, the asymmetric mergers take place at more often at lower and lower redshift. There are two lines on this plot. One is the solid and one is the dashed line. And the reason we plot them is to make sure that we are not impacted by the basically the biases of the instrument, LISA instrument itself. So there is no selection bias, etc. And so whatever is the true distribution, how faithfully can we recover it? So that's what the dashed line is showing us, which is hard, which is great. There is not much of a change from the solid to the dashed line. So whatever the slope of that line is in nature, we should be, at least ought to be able to recover it. So here it is. So this is the core. So here, how do you use this? You say, oh, there is a measure in the universe. I know the distance to it. I know the mass ratio. And then you say, oh, okay, I want a redshift of this source. I go to this plot or a plot of this type, and I infer statistically for that source and say, this was its mass ratio. What is the likelihood for, what are the probability distribution for its redshift? But it says, oh, if it was a Q, if the mass ratio was equal to one, then you want to bet more that this was a higher redshift source than, for example, redshift two. If it is asymmetric, let's say the mass ratio is 0.1, then we would argue that, oh, this is really not likely to be a super high redshift merger. It is most likely happening at the lowest bin of your redshift distribution. So, and then this way you can say, okay, for one source, I get two data points. One is for DL, the luminosity distance, with its own error bar, and one is Q with its own error bar. But then you process that Q or mass ratios with its error bar through this pipeline, which has its own error bar, and then you get a point in the redshift with its own error bar. So at the end, you have a redshift with its own error bar, and then luminosity distance with its own error bar. These two will give you H of Z with its own error bar. And then you can repeat this for every source. Like if there is one source, you get a very crude estimate of expansion rate. And as you have more and more sources, well, of course, like any other technique, the error shrinks as 1/√ of n is typically done and assumed in the literature. So this is the core of the argument. If you have any questions, please ask. Otherwise, I'll move on to the next slide.
Questions here?
It's all clear.
Yes, you show later some specific shape of the conditional PDF PZ given Q.
Sorry, could you repeat the question again?
Yeah, sorry. Do you have any picture showing the conditional PDF P of Z given Q?
So, oh no, I don't. I didn't make. So for every Q to show you how it, so we just showed this plot, the cumulative sum for mass ratio less than a half. We could have shown this for different bins of Q. This is, I think, what you're saying, like plot this line for Q of 0.1, point like one. We didn't do that. But you're right. That would have been a direct plot for P of Z and Q. You're right.
Thank you.
Other questions? Go ahead.
No other questions here.
One other surprise. That it was that slope that I showed you does depend on the seed mass. I actually had a theory about this, which I, as I'm speaking to you, I forgot about my own theory, that why this should happen. That if the mass ratio, if the seed mass is smaller, the slope is higher. And if the mass ratio, if the seed mass is high, its higher slope is shallower. So there are multiple things that can affect the slope. For example, it's all about the mass ratio of the supermassive binary system. For example, let's say we put this binary system in a gaseous environment, and this one accretes from some circumbinary accretion disk. This, if this happens, we know that the gas is actually primarily accreted onto the secondary or the smaller black hole as opposed to the primary, and that will tend to bring Q up equal to one, to bring the Q to be in towards equal mass mergers. So is this more effectively happening for larger seed masses? I don't know. I haven't analyzed those simulations in detail. But this is a result of a simulation, a hydro simulation. One thing that one can do is to actually bring this also in your calculation. So also you can also fit for the slope of this line at the same time. And so now for each measurement, you have an extra unknown, but it's a Bayesian paradigm. So you can have hundreds of unknown with one known parameter, it's fine. And the idea is that you incorporate this into your unknown, and also at the end of the day, when you have many samples, you will have an estimate for this slope as well. And then, so it's a joint fit for Hubble expansion and the slope of this line. And this will also inform you about the seed mass of the universe. So it's a technique that can attack two things at once. One is the expansion rate. What is the seed mass? Is it 10 to 4? Is it 10 to 5? So any questions on this one? I guess this is clear. So this is the second part of our result in that very short paper. And then this is basically it. I mean, this I have covered all that was in the paper. And the only question that I wanted to like to wrap it up is, well, you might ask, what about LIGO black holes? Like, can we use this technique for, a stellar mass black holes? I actually, when I thought about this, my idea was to use it for LIGO black holes. And this was my idea that in globular clusters, in a dynamical assembly channel, there is a time that it takes for the globular cluster to get relaxed. And when the globular cluster gets relaxed, there is a radial segregation of masses. The more massive black holes are at the core of the cluster, and then the least massive ones are at the edge of the cluster. When this is happening, basically what it means is that Q, the mass ratio coming from dynamical channel from a globular cluster, is mostly equal to one. Because, because of mass segregation that is happening in a dynamical system. But for a global cluster, it takes some time to get there. So in the initial phase of a global cluster, it is not that when you form one, it's already mass segregated. It's not like that. It takes time. And so you can imagine that the reverse process happens, that in this case, more asymmetric measures happen earlier and then more symmetric measures happen later, as opposed to what I discussed for supermassive black holes and seeds, etc. So you might imagine, oh, in the beginning of the formation of the global cluster, there is, it's a chaos and the system tries to settle in, and asymmetric measures can happen. And then over time, yes, it settles in and there is mass segregation, and any measure that happens most likely will be an equal mass measure. So I had this idea. And then one thing that I forgot about is that the time scale for a global cluster to settle to its mass segregated phase is very short, actually. It's about like 100 million years. And this is a problem that we cannot, also, like, I'm not sure how well Q is measured by the current and the even future generation of detectors, ground-based detectors, for stellar mass black holes. That's a separate issue. But even if we could measure Q perfectly, the time scale for this transition is so small and global cluster forms so dynamically that really doing this is going to be super difficult, because the fraction of your mergers that will have asymmetric ratios is very small because the time scale of them is small. And then you are going to be have to take into account the birth rate of these global clusters that happen continuously over time. So you have an element that washes out that information. And there are also other channels that are still other channels of formation other than besides the dynamical formation channel that can also wash out this information that you wanted to tease out. So this idea will not work for stellar mass black holes. And this is when we did, oh, like how about like supermassive black holes? What would be the situation there? But the situation of supermassive black holes is more clear because of the seed mass hypothesis that, oh, I start with something similar for everybody and let the system run. And then this, of course, will result into more asymmetric at lower and lower redshifts. So again, this was a very short, like four-page-ish paper. I was told to talk about this regardless for like 20, 30 minutes. This is all there was in the paper. I hope you learned something. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Any questions here?
Thank you.
Thank you, Leandro. Sorry.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I have a question of curiosity. Could you comment about the simulation that you use to infer this relation?
Yes.
How much the result, the cumulative distribution to depend on the simulation you use?
Yes, very good question. The simulation is 250 megaparsec on each side, and it's a fully hydro simulation. And of course, it has its own cosmology assumed. And one valid question is that, is it a cyclic argument? You're using something that has built-in cosmology to drive those lines, and you want to use those lines to infer cosmology. Is that a cyclic argument? It can be if the result of your if that line is super sensitive to your assumed cosmology of your simulation, yes, this would be cyclic. There are many arguments laid out that say, oh no, the box size is enough big, and this is mostly hydro driven, so the cosmology part should be should not really affect the result. But you know, in order to show this properly, one has to analyze the same set of simulations with different cosmologies and show that, oh, you see, this is the variance of this line. It's not so much depending on the type of cosmology we use. We haven't done this, but it, other than hand wavy argument that this should not depend on the assumed cosmology, we haven't gone beyond this because we just wanted to put the idea out. But this is one question. The other is about the hydro stuff, like how much the assumed hydro part of the simulation affect this line. I think this is the most difficult thing to answer because the hydro recipes are the most uncertain in any simulation. And as I touched upon it, if you put a binary in a circumbinary accretion disk, you are going to mess with the Q of the binary because of mass accretion. So how much of it is modeled? How much is paid attention to this? How much this will impact the slope will depend on the time scale, the gas density, et cetera, that you think these binaries will experience in the course of a merger. And I don't. There is no solid like understanding about this. Different simulations tell you different things, and which means that at the end of the day, you want to really just parameterize that line and fit for it instead of assume it and go after the cosmology. The best way to do it is to say, you know, I leave that line. I model it as some power law with some slope. And I want to also fit for that line and see what the data directly tells me. But how you want to interpret it? Is it the seed mass? Was it the gas accretion? I think one can debate one way or the other. So I think, did I answer your question or did I set something tangential?
Can I have a small question?
Yeah.
Could you use this method for mergers of more than two black holes?
For the mergers of what?
More than two black holes.
Oh, more than two black holes. And what do you mean by that? More than two black holes?
When you have either quadruples, like two twos,
oh,
or three.
Hmm.
You can keep going.
More than, so if you want to go after hierarchical channels, like 2+1, 2+2, stuff like that, right? So you want to tie their presence to cosmology.
Yeah, because the reason why I'm asking is whether this can be used to constrain some scenarios of formation of some supermassive black holes, because of the different scenarios we have.
Right. I mean, is there a reason to tie the, let's say, the, okay, so one thing you can say is to say, I am a believer that everything comes from hierarchical channels. I don't believe in globular clusters or, you know, binary, stellar binary evolution. I only believe in hierarchical channels. Okay.
Okay.
Now, do you have a reason to believe that some characteristics of these hierarchical systems evolve with redshift? Do you think the mass ratio of these systems are, they are assembled such that, like, at the end of the day, equal mass ratios happen, would take place preferentially at lower or higher redshift, however direction it might go? If you have such a, at the end of the day, if you have any reason to believe there is a P of Z given Q, you can use this technique. But is there such, I mean, I would be very, I have worked on hierarchical thing, but never thought about this. Like, is there a P of Z given Q for hierarchical systems? I have no idea if there is. But if there is, yes.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
No one online?
No question. No question.
Okay. So we have no more questions here in the room now? No. Thank you again. If there is no other questions online too. Nope. Thank you, Mohamed.
Thank you.
Next week's seminar, which will be on special properties of the large scale structures using 3-point relation functions. Thank you. I'll see you next week. Bye bye. Thank you, Mohamed.
Absolutely. Absolutely.